Lee will get Harry on the phone in just a minute and call you. I'm sure it is okay.
Okay, we will wait.
Harry says we will join you at 8. If your power fails, can you set up battery and phone in your office?
Yes, we sure can. We'll have phone and battery amp in phone office should our loop fail. Mr. Coulson said, God bless you.
And so WSM, for some 82 hours, picked up the WHAS signals. Later, WHAS returned to the air. All told, broadcasting for 187 and a half hours of uninterrupted service. It sent out 115,000 messages. WSM, in turn, fed the broadcast to others. As station manager Harry Stone tells it,
no record of radio's part in the Louisville flood should omit the role played by a purely mythical radio network, which we call the Volunteer Network. This was a group of more than 200 radio stations scattered throughout the United States who, of their own free will, asked permission to rebroadcast the flood bulletins coming out of Louisville. The Federal Communications Commission in Washington waived all rules and regulations during this period so that these stations picked up the messages right off the air and rebroadcast them either as part of their news or as a program to stimulate Red Cross donations. These stations did a marvelous job.
They called it the greatest voluntary network in history, but it wasn't radio as such. Carl Nielsen, a technician at WHAS then, as now, explains it this way.
I also remember receiving a cable from the British Broadcasting Corporation for permission to carry these messages. The National Broadcasting Company, Mutual Broadcasting Company, as well, of course, as our own affiliate, asked permission to carry everything we originated. If you will notice, I said to carry the messages. I didn't say carry our broadcast or programs. They were not programs. Far from it. Actually, we were a communication system. We received definite permission from the Federal Communication Commission to use WHAS as a communication system and not as a broadcast station.
Nielsen was one of many behind-the-scenes workers, among them hundreds of volunteers who offered to take the messages, type them, do anything. Catherine Steele recalls these people and the place in which they worked.
And of course, it was cold, and I remember the coal or the gasoline, was it gasoline heaters, you know, the heat all went down the gasoline. And of course, after a certain amount of time, why, that throws off fumes. And of course, you're typing and have to keep your eyes from smarting. And then they gave us typhoid shots. And between it all, while we were sort of operating at a disadvantage, but the one element of danger that everybody kept working on in the building was fire. We were also conscious of don't let paper fall and don't let anything accumulate that could someone could drop a match into it and cause fire. And of course, with the coal lamps and the gasoline heaters, it was very precarious.
But the girls worked on, hours on end, many of them. Families were somewhere else in the city. Hot food was scarce, living conditions primitive. But the hope that they might help drove them on.
The people were calling for help, asking for boats to be sent, and asking advice. One woman, I will never forget her, she says, "Lady, my husband is out of town, and I have 5 children. What do you think I should do?" I said, "Do you have a car?" And she says, "Yes." I says, "Can you drive it?" She says, "Yes." I says, "Well, I'd get in and bring your children as far east as you can. She was very close to Shawnee Park at the time. But everything happened so fast, and the water came up so fast. The one man told me that he had gone into his house to get as much clothing as he could for his wife and his children. And he says, "Lady, the water is around my waist now." I don't know where he was, but he says, which way can I get out of here?" That's how fast the water came up. Everything happened so fast.
There were other calls from across the nation by people offering to help, to send men and machinery, food and medicine. Calls came to WSM, too, as Harry Stone remembers.
"I remember the man in a southern city who, after hearing an appeal for shear pins for outboard motors, phoned us to have the boys in Louisville use welding rod cut in small pieces, which did a good job. Or the president of a large company making a disinfectant, who called and gave a precise formula for purifying drinking water. Coast Guard boats were offered from Tampa, Florida, battery-powered radios, a large supply of storage batteries, cots, blankets, food, medicine, and even a plain load of bread were all offered and accepted. Getting these supplies to Louisville was no simple problem, and it was only through the full cooperation of the highway departments of Kentucky and Tennessee, as well as the L&N Railroad and American and Eastern Airlines, that this was accomplished."
In Louisville, WHAS staffers such as Carl Nielsen searched for their own needed supplies.
"The thing that is most vivid in my mind was the going to a Sears store on Broadway in a rowboat with the store manager and rowing up and down the aisles trying to locate battery radios, dry cell batteries, and storage batteries. While there, it dawned on us that some of the workers at the studio would need winter clothing to keep warm since we had no heat in the building. And we also loaded in the boat as much winter clothing as we could carry."
And for other members of the WHAS staff and other people throughout the relief picture, the realization that while they remained at their posts, everything they owned might be underwater. Carl Schmidt, another WHAS technician, remembers getting free from his job after several days.
"One of the boys, knowing I was pretty much concerned about the condition of things, I had lost complete contact with what was going on in my particular neighborhood. I knew it was well underwater, but I kept hoping that maybe, like the rest, everybody was hoping, maybe they weren't too hard hit. But I didn't have very long to wait when they went down one day, long after the water began to recede. And a fellow very kindly rowed me down the street, supposedly, but it was nothing but just a big pond, and we rowed between two rooftops, and that was one of the places was my home. And very jokingly, I commented, well, I believe I left the window open, because the top of one of the windows had been left open, and of course, it was very easy to see a crack there."
The station, as the newspaper, attempted to distribute as much information as possible concerning the whereabouts of evacuees. Some of the information came from far-off cities to which refugees had been taken. Nashville was one of these, as Harry Stone reports.
"As might be expected, many people left Louisville and other points along the Ohio River to seek safety elsewhere. In some instances, train loads of them were moved to other points where they were housed and fed. Complete lists of these people were sent to us at WSM, where we made card files which also included the names of individuals and families who, of their own accord, had phoned or wired us. Within a matter of 2 or 3 days, this list grew to the enormous proportion of 15,000 names. By means of this list, it was possible to tell frantic friends and relatives exactly where anyone who had reported was located. Finally, on Thursday morning of that week, some very tired WHAS announcers informed us that the situation was returning to normal and that they no longer needed our assistance. And so, after a total of 82 hours of the most thrilling and even frightening broadcasting our industry has ever experienced, we took up where we left off the Sunday before. The next day I went to Louisville and took with me the card files on the 15,000 persons who had temporarily left their homes. These were delivered to the offices of Neville Miller, then mayor of Louisville, who had with him at the time Governor Happy Chandler and President Roosevelt's personal representative in the flood area, Harry Hopkins. Perhaps my most vivid recollection of Louisville was when I later walked into the office of Judge Bingham in the Courier Journal building. There he sat at his desk, on which was a kerosene lamp and a bottle of purified water, which somehow seemed to be symbolic of the trial Louisville had just been through. The judge was smiling and very profuse with his thanks. But behind it all, I sensed a confidence and assurance which convinced me that he knew all the time that Louisville would win its battle with the elements and go on to greater things.
And Louisville did go on to greater things. Agencies continued to work on that first problem of where people were. The Red Cross, for example. Elsie Mettle, then executive secretary, remembers doing this from the start.
Mr. Kennedy Helm, who was chairman of the Red Cross, called us to a meeting in the Inter-Southern building, as it was then, and informed us that there was every prospect of the river rising, coming down 4th Street. And that, of course, just seemed inconceivable at that time. We went back, of course, to our office, and what kept us most busy during those first few days was the very many calls that came in from all over the country, even before the river was very high, from relatives and friends who were very alarmed about the territory where their loved ones were. This became such a big part of our service that, of course, we had to stay up all night at our office, and then later maintained the Highland Branch Library purely for what we called welfare inquiries. And then it became later still a relocation office. The inquiries came from all over the world by telephone and telegram and every conceivable way. And, of course, at that time, it was very difficult to tell where these people were. So we could give them information whether their air house area was wet or dry. But it was some time before we were able to relocate the families and get them together.
And other work continued. Tent cities built to house the homeless, medicine rushed in from all points, and typhoid shots given all over the city. Sometimes they did it in front of stores, right on the street. Other times people went to medical centers, like the Red Cross headquarters. Miss Mettle recalls that people held onto their pets wherever they went, even when going for the typhoid shots.
Office then was over the Rialto Theater, quite a small office because compared with our present headquarters. And during the time of the typhoid inoculation, men and women and children and would bring their canaries and their dogs and all their pets up those very narrow stairs to our office. And I don't think I'll ever forget all the conglomeration and the congestion at that time.
One flood victim was Louisville's library. Some 30,000 books in the flooded basement swelled with such force that they snapped steel supports and bookshelves like matchsticks. Edna Grauman, head of the reference department, came to work after the flood had subsided.
It almost breaks your heart to walk into a building that you've worked in for years and is lovely and see it just look like, a perfect mess.
But the library would not let those 30,000 volumes go down without a stab at saving them. They were packed in 3 freight cars and shipped to Philadelphia. There?
We used chemicals to wash some of them, and they had these great big dryer drums that they dried them in. And the drum that they used, I know that when I was up there, they showed me it was the one that they used to dry enamel on automobiles. And they had oscillating fans to dry the books when they put them up. You see, you have to take all the glue off, because the glue is what makes your mildew. They took all the glue off, and they secured an empty garage way out in Philadelphia. I think it was a three-story building that was empty. And they just spread. After they had used these chemicals and washed them and dried them, they brought them out and spread them out here. And then in April, I went up and spent 2 weeks up there choosing the books that we needed immediately, throwing out the things that I thought weren't worth binding, and trying to straighten out details.
20,000 volumes out of 30,000 were saved, and the library, too, was cleaned up. Back in service within days, and no overdue charged to flood victims late in returning books. The mess at the library was typical of what happened across much of the city, inflicted as it was with $52 million damage.
When you could drive down any of the streets through the West End after the flood had subsided, and it was a common thing to see the householder had dragged the grand piano out on the front porch, and he was in the process of breaking it up with a sledgehammer or an axe because it was totally and completely ruined. All the legs had dropped off of their tables and their chairs. Practically every front yard was stacked high with their ruined household goods. I recall one of our police officers, out of six rooms of furniture, he saved a refrigerator and a Browning shotgun. That was every piece of furniture the man had left.
The big job of cleaning up was yet to come, but the immediate problem had been licked. And though property losses were tremendous, the death count was quite low. Lower, actually, than a similar period of time in a non-disaster period. Governor Chandler toured flood-stricken areas.
There was not much what you call griping or pleas for sympathy. They just got right up. They just got right up out of the mud and out of the water and started building back. And they did it in a remarkably short time.
Neil Dalton recalls...
In traveling back and forth across from around 4th and Oak, around that area, which I did somewhat on rafts and other things, and then beginning to get stories from around the city of what the situation was, what would happen to the utilities, for example, the sewers, pipelines, and all of that, that would be almost a hopeless job to repair and reclaim. But I was wrong. I think it was on... February 3rd, they lifted the ban in the around my area, and I was able to get back to my own home. They lifted a ban on a two-mile radius, and that for me was the beginning of the rehabilitation of the physical property. The same thing went on all over town, and I think it was a truly amazing thing what people did for themselves. There was some griping, of course, but by and large, people saw that it was an unfortunate thing, but there it was, and something had to be done about it.
Alan Trout.
I've never seen anything like it before or since. The friendliness and cooperation I saw during the flood has stimulated me through all these years.
Mayor Neville Miller.
It's hard to pick out any special heroes. The things I remember most about the thing I remember most about the flood is that everyone did what he was asked to do and did it well, whether it was a big job or a little job. For example, two of my personal aides were Dr. Kent, who was then president of the University of Louisville, and Rabbi Joseph Rauch. They wrote my speeches for the radio. They greeted dignitaries like Harry Hopkins. They went on missions where we had special trouble. Then, when the mayor's office became in bad condition and untidy due to lack of janitor service, Joe Rauch became the head janitor, and he did a grand job. The mayor's office looked presentable from there on out, tidy all through the flood. When Rabbi Rauch took his farewell after the flood, he came in to tell me goodbye, and I told him if I ever ran a hotel, I wanted him as my head bellboy, and he accepted. If in my later years I ever retire and buy a hotel in Florida, I'm going to hold Rabbi Rauch to that promise. Of course, the greatest thing that we all remember is the spirit of Louisville, the firm, optimistic way everyone met the flood. There was no defeatism. Yes, it was tough. The losses were great. But Louisville was not going under, and we were going to lick the flood no matter how high it went. And that spirit carried over into the cleanup job also. The best example of that is I think, the community chess. The campaign of the community chess was scheduled to start Friday night when the flood was well underway. The Brown Hotel was flooded. The campaign was postponed until April, and with misgivings we started later in April. For years, the campaign had never quite gone over the top, always around 95% or so. After all the losses which Louisville had taken in 1937, the campaign in April of 1937 went over the top. A great tribute to the community chess, a great tribute to Miss Mary Stotzenberg and to the city of Louisville.
Louisville was just one city of many along the Ohio and other Kentuckiana rivers, but its story, a tale of courage, of determination, of refusal to give up, is one that stays with us today. Of Kentucky in 1937, Governor Chandler said,
"The memory that stands out, I think, above everything else is the willingness of the people to accept this tragic and sudden and cruel blow, and then having realized that it had come upon them to determine in their own hearts and minds that they were not going to be defeated by it, that they were going to get up and fight back." And we ask them, all of those of us who were luckier and who did not suffer nearly so much as a great many of our people did, it was our business to try to cheer them up and make assurances to them that we'd stand by and help them. And I think everybody that had any part in the recovery, which I say was genuine and real and wasn't long before it came about, it was a remarkable recovery. I ought to feel proud that they lived in a time like that and lived with such a grand people. That was a fine hour. They made a fine showing.
The darkest hour of dreary 1937 became this state's and this city's greatest hour. People rising to unexpected heights, doing unexpected things, revealing unexpected charity and faith. That is the lesson of Louisville 1937. We close with the words of Neville Miller.
"Looking back over the 20 years, I remember a community in which all its citizens answered the call to duty without hesitation and did what was required to help those in distress. A community which by its actions changed what could have been a disaster from which Louisville would have been years in recovering into another step forward in Louisville's progress. Louisville met the challenges of the flood, and today looks back on what we used to refer to as a damp spell in 1937 with pride and renewed confidence in its ability as a community."
You have been listening to Louisville 1937, a documentary presentation of Station WHAS, written by William Small, Director of News, production by Bill Aldrich, technicians Paul Kiefer, Paul Devine, Clarence Hansen, and Carl Nielsen. Your narrator has been Pete French.